Chapter 19, A Reenshrinement and a Reunion. Sanchi lay at a distance of 25 miles from Bhopal, the capital of the then state of Madhya Bharat, the hill on which it stood being an offshoot of the eastern Vindhyas, the celebrated mountain range separating the Ganges basin from the Deccan. According to one of the articles I had proofread for the Diamond Jubilee souvenir, and which subsequently appeared in its pages, the history of Sanchi the Incomparable, as the author enthusiastically called it, filled a period of about 1,200 years, from the reign of Ashoka down almost to the end of the ancient period of Indian history. It thus coincided with what he termed the epic story of the rise and fall of Buddhism in the land of its birth. During the 600 years that followed the Muslim invasions of the 12th and 13th centuries, the stupas, monasteries and temples of Sanchi fell into a state of increasing neglect and decay, and by the time General Cunningham visited the place in the middle of the last century, many of the monuments were little more than a heap of rubble, from which grew bushes and even trees. Besides surveying the area and carrying out excavations, the great archaeologist sunk shafts into several of the stupas, and in the relic chamber of what was subsequently known as Stupa No. 3, he discovered the steatite boxes containing the tiny fragments of bone that were the sole mortal remains of the two arahants, Shariputra and Moggallana. It was these same fragments of bone, these same sacred relics, that had laid in a London museum for 90 years, and that, after being presented to the Mahabodhi Society by the British government, had been given such an enthusiastic reception by the people of India. Now, having concluded their visits to different parts of the Buddhist world, with a visit to the Kingdom of Cambodia, they are about to be re-enshrined in their place of origin. On the 29th of November 1952, therefore, these sacred relics were taken in procession from the Sri Dharmarajika Vihara to Howrah Station. Here, a special train was waiting, and after being carried along the platform on the head of a civic dignitary, the silver gilt casket was placed in the specially decorated tourist carriage provided by the Government of India. At 10 o'clock in the evening, the train left, slowly drawing out of the great railway terminus to repeated shouts of Sadhu from the white-garmented devotees. During the final stages of my work on the Diamond Jubilee souvenir, it had become increasingly obvious to me that Devapriya Valasinha was taking it for granted that I would be accompanying the sacred relics to Sanchi. And as they set out on their homeward journey, I accordingly found myself seated in a compartment of the specially decorated tourist carriage, together with the familiar silver gilt casket. With me in the compartment were Bhikkhu Silabhadra and four or five other monks, mostly Sinhalese. As the night wore on, however, the monks slipped away one by one until only Silabhadra and I were left. Having bolted the door, we therefore stretched out on the seats, being careful to lie with our heads towards the sacred relics, and soon were fast asleep. We were not allowed to sleep for long. At Gaya, the carriage was besieged by people wanting to take darshan of the sacred relics, and we had to open the windows, a process involving much raising of gauze screens and wooden shutters, and hold the reliquary up against the iron window bars so that they could see it, and, if they were lucky, put their hand through the bars and touch it. In the course of the following day and night, this procedure was repeated at most of the other stations at which the train halted. Cedar Badger and I therefore spent the greater part of the journey sitting opposite each other in the window seats, with the reliquary resting on the semicircular ledge between us. Whenever people wanted to take darshan, we lifted it up a foot or so in order to give them a better view. Sometimes garlands of marigolds were thrust through the bars, as well as currency notes and handfuls of small change. Curiously enough, none of the other monks offered to take turns with us in looking after the sacred relics. Venerable Sangharasana was not, of course, among them, being busy with his own anniversary celebrations at Sarnath, and we in fact did not see so much as a flutter of their yellow robes again. By the time the train reached Sanchi, my elderly companion and I were therefore feeling more than a little tired. But we did not mind. We had done our duty by the sacred relics, and in any case, the thunderous sadhus with which they were greeted by the waiting crowd were more than enough to revive our flagging spirits. From the train, the sacred relics were transferred to a lavishly decorated pavilion of the traditional Sinhalese type. As soon as they had been installed there, I asked one of the volunteers to show me where my own quarters were, and was at once conducted to a tent, which I had no difficulty in recognising as standard army issue. The fact was that the modern Sanchi consisted of little more than a tiny village and the archaeological area, so there was no question of its being able to provide accommodation for even a fraction of the people who would be coming from all over India, as well as from the various Buddhist countries, for the re-enshrinement of these sacred relics and the opening of the new Sanchi Vihara. The Indian army had therefore been asked to help out, with the result that a veritable township of tents had sprung up in the vicinity of the archaeological area. Moreover, the township had been laid out in streets and lanes, as it were, and the individual tents consecutively numbered, so that the Mahabodhi Society's invitees had no difficulty in finding the tent they had been allocated. My own tent was situated not far from the centre of the township, and on entering I found that the monk with whom I was to share it had already arrived and was busy supervising the arrangement of his rather luxurious bedding. The monk turned out to be Narada Thera, whom I had last seen in Kathmandu almost exactly a year ago. Though I had little sympathy for his narrow and formalistic type of Buddhism, I was glad to see him again, while he, on his part, greeted me with evident cordiality, and in a manner that suggested he was not sorry to have someone on whom to exercise his well-known buttonholing proclivities. I was not ready to be buttonholed just then, however, and having arranged my own far from luxurious bedding, went in quest of Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami, who I knew would be attending the International Buddhist Cultural Conference that was being held that afternoon as part of the celebrations. After a brief search, I found their tent, which was not far from my own, and on lifting the flap, had the satisfaction of being greeted by my two friends with exclamations of surprise and delight. Though a regular correspondence had been kept up between us, we had not seen one another since the autumn of the previous year, when they had stayed with me in Kalimpong, and I had stayed with them in Gum. And our reunion, the reunion of three kindred spirits, was therefore a joyful one. Indeed, the prospect of seeing the mild-mannered German Lama and his vivacious Parsi consort again had been one of the main reasons for my accompanying the sacred relics to Sanchi, and I had lived in pleasurable anticipation of the reunion for some days. Having as much in common as we did, and having not met me for so long, the three of us naturally had quite a lot to say to one another. Unfortunately, we had very little time in which to say it. The 11 o'clock bell had already rung, and I had to go and join the yellow-robed figures who were streaming towards the dining area for the ceremonial food offering, which, in Theravadin eyes, was one of the most important parts of the day's proceedings. After the monks had eaten and the sermon of thanksgiving had been delivered, it would be the turn of the laity, and when they had been fed, it would be time for the International Buddhist Cultural Conference to begin. Before hurrying off, however, I made arrangements with Lama Govinda and Li Gotami for us to spend some time together later on. The cultural conference was held in a pandal, or temporary structure, of bamboo poles covered with white cloth, and its proceedings lasted for nearly 8 hours, with only one short interval halfway through. Dr. Radhakrishnan, the Vice President of India, presided. Pandit Nehru, the Prime Minister, gave the opening address, and some 20 or 30 monks, scholars, politicians, diplomats, and people of local importance delivered speeches and read papers or simply spoke about whatever happened to be uppermost in their mind at that particular moment. So many contributions to the proceedings of the conference were there, indeed, that with the exception of Narada Thera's, Lama Govinda's, and my own, all recollection of them has long since faded from my mind. Narada Thera read a scholarly paper on consciousness, in which, with characteristic aplomb, he took the opportunity of criticising Dr. Radhakrishnan for having misrepresented the Buddhist, that is, the Theravadin Buddhist, conception of citta in his well-known work on Indian philosophy. The object of the criticism listened attentively, but did not seem unduly perturbed. Lama Govinda likewise read a paper, but unfortunately he read it without once raising his eyes from the manuscript, and in a voice so low that he was seen rather than heard to read it. Only years later did I learn that at one point he had announced the establishment of the Arya Maitreya Mandala, the first Vajrayana Buddhist organisation to be introduced into the West. My own contribution to the proceedings was confined to a short speech in which I dealt with what I knew was a quite sensitive issue, the issue of Buddha Jayanti, or the fact that 5 years after independence, the government of India had still not declared the Buddha's birthday a public holiday. Jesus Christ was born in Palestine, I told the conference, having worked my way up to the point, but his birthday is a public holiday in India. Prophet Muhammad was born in Arabia, but his birthday too is a public holiday. The Buddha, however, was born in India, but his birthday... It was not necessary for me to complete the sentence, which drew a burst of laughter, followed by prolonged applause, from Buddhist and Hindu alike. I thereupon concluded my speech with a strong appeal to the government of India to take immediate action and honour India's greatest son by declaring his birthday, his Buddha or Buddha Jayanti, a public holiday. Dr. Radhakrishnan could hardly ignore so marked an expression of popular feeling, and in his closing remarks adverted to what I had said. The request ought to have been made while the Prime Minister was present at the meeting, he observed, with an air of slight displeasure. Nevertheless, he would convey the request to his government for its consideration. Pleased though I was to have achieved this much, at least, Radhakrishnan's observation that the request ought to have been made while the Prime Minister was present at the meeting struck me as distinctly unreasonable. I was not to know that Pandit Nehru would be leaving early, and in any case I had had no voice whatever in determining the order in which the different speakers should address the gathering. Though the cultural conference was the longest of the events taking place during the two-day celebrations, it was not, of course, the most important. The most important event, the one for the sake of which we had all made the journey to Sanchi, was the re-enshrinement of the sacred relics of the two Arahants, and therewith the opening of the new Sanchi Vihara. Such being the case, it is strange that, though I was undoubtedly present on the occasion, recollection of the ceremonies that then took place has faded from my mind even more completely than has recollection of the various contributions to the proceedings of the cultural conference the day before. According to a report that appeared in the pages of the Mahabodhi Journal a few months later, quote, amidst chanting of Buddhist hymns and recitation of suttas, to the accompaniment of blowing of conch shells and ringing of bells, the sacred relics of the two chief disciples of Lord Buddha were enshrined at 5:20 p.m. in the newly built vihara adjacent to the old stupa on the historic Sanchi Hill. End quote. But of all this I remember nothing. I do not even remember the procession in which, according to the same account, the sacred relics were taken to the vihara from the pavilion in which they had been placed the previous day. What I do remember, however, and remember very vividly, are the hours which, earlier that same day, I had spent with Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami exploring the archaeological area. The sky was a deep cloudless blue, and the sun shone warmly on ochre-coloured earth and pinkish-brown sandstone, as reverently we moved from one ruined or restored monument to another. The principal object of our attention was stupa number one, which, since it was the biggest of the stupas in the area, was known as the Great Stupa. Originally built of brick by the Emperor Ashoka in the 3rd century BCE, it had been encased in stone 100 years later, during the Sunga period, when the stone terrace, balustrades and flights of steps had also been added, so that from then onwards it had a diameter of over 120 feet and a height of 54 feet. With its four massive stone gateways, additions of the 1st century BCE, the great stupa towered above the surrounding monuments without appearing to dominate them, creating an extraordinary impression of dignity, harmony, and repose. After making our way round the upper terrace, thus circumambulating the stupa, we spent some time admiring the gateways which stood at the four cardinal points of the ground terrace. Each gateway consisted of two square pillars with dwarf, elephant or lion capitals, and these capitals were surmounted by a series of three architraves, all richly carved with human and animal forms, as well as with figures from Indian mythology. Originally the gates had been crowned by the symbols of Buddhism, the Wheel of the Dharma and the Triratna Trident. But of these only fragments now remained. Looking up at the panels of the architraves, 20, 30 and 40 feet above our heads, we could make out not only separate figures, but whole scenes. There were representations of events in the life of the Buddha and episodes from Buddhist history, as well as representations of the world of the gods. And Lama Govinda, more knowledgeable in such matters than either Lee Gotami or myself, even managed to identify particular incidents from his beloved Jataka stories. In the case of the scenes representing events in the life of the Buddha, the Buddha's own presence was indicated by the appropriate symbol, for in the 1st century BCE, the master was not depicted in human form and would not be so depicted for another 100 or more years. Stupa number three, the stupa in which the steatite boxes containing the earthly remains of Shariputra and Moggallana had been discovered, turned out to be situated in a village more than 6 miles from Sanchi proper, and we therefore did not see it. We did, however, see the monolithic Ashoka pillar that stood next to the great stupa. This had the usual round shaft and bell-shaped capital, surmounted by 4 lions set back to back, and bore on its highly polished surface one of Ashoka's celebrated edicts. As I learned later on, the edict threatened with excommunication any monk or nun who created schism in the Buddhist community. We also saw the 4 pillars, which were, I think, practically all that remained of a small temple belonging to the Gupta period. These were of an almost Hellenic severity and simplicity, and served to remind me that between Buddhist India and ancient Greece there existed a certain similarity of ideals. But whether ruined or restored, the monuments of the past were not the only objects to claim our attention. From time to time, we lifted up our eyes to the nearby ridge and to the dazzlingly white shape of the Chetty Yagiri Vihara, as the new Sanchi Temple was called. Architecturally speaking, it was, I thought, a greater success than the Mula Gandakuti Vihara at Sarnath. For whereas the Mula Gandakuti was impressive only when seen squarely from one side, the Chetty Yagiri Vihara presented an impressive appearance regardless of the angle from which it was viewed. At one point in our exploration of the archaeological area, we were joined by Narada Thera. Lama Govinda was already well acquainted with him, and had, as I knew, no more sympathy for his narrow and formalistic type of Buddhism than I had myself. In fact, it was quite impossible for either of us to take him very seriously, or to regard him as anything other than a figure of fun. So much was this the case, indeed, that we subsequently bestowed upon him the sobriquet of Auntie Narada, for with his high-pitched voice and his prim and pedantic ways, the elderly doyen of the English-speaking monks of Ceylon was much more like somebody's maiden aunt than a real monk. Both his primness and pedantry were evinced within minutes of his joining my 2 friends and myself. Lama Govinda had brought along with him a large, lavishly produced volume on Buddhist art, and among the illustrations to this volume there were some exceptionally beautiful Tibetan tankas of different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Thinking these would be of interest to him, Lama Govinda gave Narada Thera the volume to look at, but after turning a few pages, the Sinhalese monk handed it back, remarking, "No doubt the pictures are very nice, but as a Buddhist monk, I'm not allowed to appreciate beauty." It was as though Govinda was a wicked Mara who, through the medium of Buddhist art, was trying to tempt him away from the right path with the lure of beauty, a temptation to which he, the virtuous monk, nobly refused to succumb. But this was not the only experience of Narada Thera's type of Buddhism that I was to have that day. On entering the tent some hours later, I found him, not to say caught him, hastily swallowing a handful of vitamin tablets. "Oh, Banti, I did not know you took anything after 12 o'clock, I exclaimed in genuine astonishment, for my elder brother in the Sangha was well known for his strict adherence to the Vinaya rules, and eating after 12 o'clock was popularly regarded as one of the most serious offences a monk could commit. As soon as he had finished swallowing the vitamin tablets, Narada Thera hastened to put me right. "They were medicine," he explained, "and since they were medicine, they could be taken after 12 o'clock without infringing the Vinaya rules." To me, this did not sound very convincing. Vitamin tablets were surely taken not to cure disease, but to provide nourishment. As such, they were not medicine, but food, and as food, they could not be taken after 12 o'clock. But Narada-Tera was no more convinced by my arguments than I was convinced by his, and continued to insist that vitamin tablets were medicine. Indeed, by the time he went to bed, he had, without realizing it, come very close to maintaining that if someone as strict in his observance of the Vinaya as he was took vitamin tablets after 12 o'clock, then they could not be food and it must be all right to take them. Narada-Tera's type of Buddhism was not, of course, confined to Narada-Tera. It was, as I had been made aware either that or the previous morning, well represented among the Sinhalese lay Buddhists attending the celebrations. And once again it was in connection with the vexed question of Buddhist art that narrowness and formalism manifested themselves. As part of the celebration, an exhibition of Buddhist art had been organised, and among the artists contributing to the exhibition were Madame Brunner and her daughter Elizabeth. The Brunners, as their friends called them, were two highly unconventional, not to say eccentric, Hungarian Buddhists who lived together in Delhi and were, in fact, inseparable. Both women were extremely emotional, and it was said of them that whenever they failed to get their own way, they would start screaming and tearing off their clothes, a tactic that was invariably successful with modesty-conscious Indians of every kind, from landlords to shopkeepers and from bank managers to railway booking clerks. Among Elizabeth Brunner's contributions to the exhibition, there was a striking picture of the Buddha in meditation. It was quite traditional in conception, except that the Buddha was cradling in his hands not the more usual alms bowl, but a human skull. When the Sinhalese lay Buddhists saw the picture, they were shocked and outraged. The artist had committed sacrilege. She had polluted the Buddha. She had shown him in contact with a corpse. And off they rushed to complain to the organisers and to Devapriya Valasinha, and to demand that the picture be removed immediately. Devapriyaji, feeling rather out of his depth, for some reason came and consulted me, as did the unfortunate artist, who was in tears. The painting was not in the least sacrilegious, I declared. It could not even be said to be in bad taste. The skull obviously symbolised the truth of universal impermanence, and the fact that the Buddha was holding it in his hands meant that he was meditating upon that truth, or had realised it, and there could hardly be anything more truly Buddhist than that. Pollution was, in any case, a Hindu concept, and as such had no place in Buddhism. Devapriyaji was inclined to agree with me in this, as was Lama Govinda. Lee Gotami admitted that the painting made her feel uneasy. But the Sinhalese lay Buddhists were not to be mollified, and continued to clamour for the removal of the offending picture. As for Elizabeth Brunner, she made no attempt to start screaming and tearing off her clothes, probably because she knew that the Sinhalese Buddhists, being for the most part women, could scream louder than she could, and would not, in any case, have been impressed by a display of female nudity. In the end, the painting was removed from the exhibition. Had the Sinhalese lay Buddhists known that before the celebrations came to an end, I would be accepting an invitation to collaborate in the making of a Buddhist film, they would have been doubly shocked and outraged. But such was indeed the case. In the course of my second day in Sanchi, I was approached by a swarthy young man of about my own age, who introduced himself as Arjun Dev Rashk. He was a writer, he explained. In fact, he added rather shamefacedly, he was a scriptwriter and wrote scripts for Hindi films. At the moment, he was working on the script of a film to be called Ajanta, after the famous cave temples. As yet, there was no story, but the action would take place in and around the cave temples themselves, and the hero would be a young Buddhist monk. The part of the monk would be taken by Raj Kapoor, who would also be producing and directing the film. As a matter of fact, the young scriptwriter continued, Raj Kapoor had come down from Bombay with his aides for the re-enshrinement of the sacred relics, and was even now in Sanchi. He had heard me speak at the cultural conference and very much wanted to meet me. If I had no objection, he would take me to him straight away. Raj Sahib, of course, would have liked to come to me, but it was difficult for him to do so. A few minutes later, I learned why it was difficult. As we approached the actor's tent, which was situated somewhat apart from the rest of the township, I saw that it was surrounded by uniformed policemen, and that the policemen were engaged in keeping back some hundreds of excited young men and boys, who were, it seemed, hoping to catch a glimpse of Raj Kapoor when he came out. During the night, Rashk informed me with an indulgent chuckle, one young man, eluding the guards, had actually crawled underneath the canvas and emerged almost at Raj Kapoor's feet. Was Raj Kapoor very well known then? I asked. Rashk could not help smiling good-naturedly at my ignorance. Raj Kapoor was very well known indeed, he replied. He was one of the best-known male film actors of the day, and perhaps the most popular. Wherever he went, people flocked to see him. He attracted more attention than the Prime Minister himself. At this point in the conversation, I recalled that a week or two earlier, David Priyaji had told me, in confidence, that a famous Indian film star would be attending the Sanchi celebrations, but I had given no more thought to the matter. Evidently, Raj Kapoor was the famous film star in question. But before I could recall what else David Priyaji had said, I had passed through the policeman, was inside the tent, and a figure in an open-necked shirt had stepped forward from among his aides and was greeting me with folded hands. Later on, Rashk told me that Raj Kapoor was popularly known as the Clark Gable of India, but so far as my vague recollections of Gone with the Wind enabled me to judge, there was little or no outward resemblance between the American film star and his Indian counterpart. Like Rashk, Raj Kapoor was about my own age, perhaps a little older, and of above average height, at least by Indian standards. Unlike Rashk, he was so fair-skinned that he could easily have passed for a European, the more especially since his cheeks were of a distinctly roseate hue. A smile played about his rather thin lips, though his habit of raising his eyebrows gave him a slightly quizzical expression, and I noticed that his eyes were cold. Needless to say, he radiated charm, and on the occasion of our first meeting, that charm was turned exclusively in my direction. He was delighted to meet me, he declared, his voice vibrant with real or simulated emotion, and so grateful to me for taking the trouble to come and see him. As Rashk G must have told me, he was planning to produce a film called Ajanta. It would not be a Buddhist film exactly, but it would have a Buddhist theme, and the hero would be a young Buddhist monk who would embody all the noblest ideals of Buddhism, such as peace, love, and tolerance, though without ceasing to be very, very human. He himself knew nothing about Buddhism, he confessed with what was clearly intended to be disarming frankness. That was why he had been so anxious to meet me. He wanted Ajanta to be absolutely authentic, and the General Secretary of the Mahabodhi Society had given him to understand that I would be the best person to consult in this connection. David Priyaji had, it seemed, already met Raj Kapoor. Would I, then, be so very kind as to give him the benefit of my advice? He would be immensely grateful to me, and, of course, he would see to it that I was not a loser in any way. He would have liked to have had a long talk with me there and then, but unfortunately he had to return to Bombay almost immediately. If it was not asking too much, would I come and spend a few days in Bombay as the guest of RK Films? Rashji would escort me there and book me into a first-class hotel, and we could meet whenever it suited me. Would I be so kind as to accept his invitation? Would I? After a minute or two's reflection, I replied that I would. It was not that I found the famous film star's charm irresistible. It was not that, 3.5 years having passed since my last visit to Bombay, I was at all anxious to see the commercial capital of India again. It was not even that I was anxious to see the Mahabodhi Society's 2 Bombay centres, about one of which I knew Deva Priyaji was quite worried. From what Rashk and Raj Kapoor told me about Ajanta, it seemed more than likely that the film would seriously misrepresent both Buddhism and Buddhist monks. And the principal reason for my accepting Raj Kapoor's invitation was the hope that, by being involved with the production at an early stage, I might help him avoid some of the more obvious pitfalls. The following morning, therefore, Rashk and I boarded the crowded Delhi-Bombay Express and were ushered to the first-class seats which RK Films had reserved for us. As Rashk remarked, not without complacency, RK Films had ways of doing things. Before leaving Sanchi, I went and said goodbye to Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami, who were delighted to learn that I was going to Bombay. When I had finished my work with Raj Kapoor, why not come and spend a week with them in Deolali? It was only 100 miles away, and we would have more time to talk than we had had in Sanchi. Thus, as the train hurtled towards Bombay, I was able to look forward not only to a closer acquaintance with the film world, but also to another reunion of the 3 kindred spirits. End of chapter 19.